It was said, there are too many people in the world, and hundreds of millions of them will starve to death because there's not going to be enough food. That thought leads us to ask, could the population crash if people eat too much of the wrong food?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 1382nd edition of the Food Chain Radio Show and podcast. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends up there in Quebec City who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What? Folks, in 1968, Stanford biology professor Paul Ehrlich published a book entitled The Population Bomb, in which he said, and I quote, "The battle to feed all of humanity is over. In the 1970s, hundreds of millions of people will starve to death in spite of any crash programs embarked upon now. At this late date, nothing can prevent a substantial increase in the world death rate." Well, the world's population in 1968 was 3.5 billion. Today it's 8.2 billion. And get this, 1 in 8 of us are obese. Clearly, something happened to make the brilliant Stanford biology professor's prognostication fail, and fail in a very big way if you think about it. Perhaps Ehrlich failed to catch on to Norman Borlaug's Green Revolution, which was then taking place out in farm country. As Ehrlich was writing the population bomb, Borlaug was industrializing agriculture by developing new high-yield grain varieties, employing mechanization, and applying chemical fertilizers. In 1970, Borlaug, who is credited for having saved over a billion people from starvation, won the Nobel Peace Prize, while Ehrlich became a best-selling media sensation around the world. But wait, all is not quiet on the population front. In fact, the collapse in U.S. birth rates is reaching what some say are dangerous proportions. The Center for Disease Control and Prevention has just reported that the total fertility rate, which is the number of children that American women average over a lifetime, is now at an anemic 1.62, which is well below the 2.1 needed for replacement. Many couples are childless, although not by choice. 1 in 6 are simply infertile, while others have great difficulty conceiving. And so today we pause to ask, are we eating too much of the wrong food to have babies? Well, here to help us find an answer, we have Samantha Lejeune, who is researcher for the Population Research Institute and co-author with Stephen Mosher of Infertility on the Menu, which is a recent op-ed published by the Epoch Times. Samantha, welcome to the Food Chain.
Thank you for having me, Michael. I'm excited to be here.
Well, happy to have you. Population Research Institute. Well, it's obvious that you research population, right?
Yes, we do. We're mostly dedicated to dispelling the myth that the world is overpopulated. Like you brought up, that was a big cause put forward that everyone thought about this. We were going to have a population bomb and that everyone was going to die and not have enough food and that the world was overpopulated. And what we have found to be true is that that is all a big lie and that has never been true and that we have more than enough food to feed everybody on the planet. It's more of a distribution of that food. And now what we're seeing nowadays is that this food, especially in America, not only do we have enough for everyone to be fed, but it's also being dangerous for us and it's affecting our fertility even more so and having dangerous repercussions on our bodies and on our health in general.
Well, something certainly did go wrong along the way there, especially for the good Professor Paul Ehrlich, who wildly misplaced his population prognostication. Where was he? What was he thinking?
I think it was a big worry looking at our population rates going up without an understanding of kind of the natural progression of how population in general works and how, you know, more people move up and move out of the workforce. We need enough people to replace us in that workforce to keep our society and our economy going. And so many years that was very harshly pushed by the media that the world is severely overpopulated. And in order to save humanity, we need to stop having children. We see that in this stark decrease in population. And now we're starting to reap the benefits, especially when we look to countries that are a generation or two ahead of us, like Japan and Korea and China. And they're having these devastating cultural, societal, and economic effects. So much so that just recently Tokyo went to a 4-day work week to try to encourage people to have families, to spend time with loved ones, and to continue the population in the society. When we look at these societies that have gone down the path that we're headed down, we really need to learn our lesson from them and say we have a limited amount of time to change the path that we're going on.
Let's go back, if we can, to 1968. I don't think you remember those times as I do. I was living on an aircraft carrier in the South China Sea at the time, and the world was falling apart when Paul Ehrlich published the population bomb. Martin Luther King was being assassinated, Bobby Kennedy Jr. as well. Riots everywhere. The world was a tumultuous place. And when Population Bomb came out, people, I guess, really bought into it, that no matter what we do, it's too late. Hundreds of millions are going to die. Now, at that time, the president of the Population Research Institute, Stephen Mosher, was in China.
Yes.
And seeing firsthand the impact of Paul Ehrlich's The Population Bomb on the Chinese population itself by virtue of the orders being directed from the CCP. So do you want to give us a quick thumbnail of his experience of China's one-child policy, which was instituted in 1979, which was a decade after Paul Ehrlich's Population bomb. But actually, I think it was started in 1970 by a program the Chinese called Late, Long, and Few. So, which is to say, have children later and can you have fewer of them. I don't know what long meant, but that was
just. I believe the long was wait longer in between children.
Oh, okay. There you go. So, that's the program for having fewer children. And that came out right after the population bomb. Yeah. Followed up in 1979 by the one-child policy. And Stephen Mosher was there, and what did he see?
Well, Steve went over there to pursue his doctorate. He was at Stanford, and he was writing his thesis on specifically Chinese foreign affairs. And he was kind of a social political scientist. So he went over there and he was the very first American social scientist that spoke the language in China and didn't need a translator. And so what he found when he was over there was that a lot of these translators weren't actually translating what was being said to the other social scientists that he was with. And they were kind of hiding all of these horrible things that the CCP was doing and propagating. But as far as population goes, he was a part of quite a few really terrible things that he had to witness, whether that was taking women off of the street that were 9 months pregnant and forcing abortions. He had to be in the operating room watching these women be carted in like cattle and forcibly rip out their children and then sterilize them. And so this kind of opened and shined a light on the severity of this issue and how serious this one child policy was. When it's kind of put forth in the media at the time and, you know, portrayed as this good thing, you're going to save the world. You don't really see that dark side of it that Steve got to see, of that this isn't saving the world. It is destroying the family. It's destroying the society, the basis, the nuclear family. It's tearing that apart. And now we are seeing even more so the detrimental effects that it's had on entire countries and generations.
And China specifically is mm-hmm. suffering hugely from its one-child policy. It appears as though, if you look at the demographic profile, the country is getting older faster than any in history.
Yeah, and that's the big concern, is that even though the one-child policy has been done away with, there still is this huge societal norm and the societal pressure not to have children. Because you establish that for so long that you don't have kids, you have small kids in small families, that just because you undo that policy, which is a huge blessing and has done so much good, you still have that societal norm and that social peer pressure not to still have those children, which is just devastating.
And there are other reasons Chinese families don't have children as well. So we're going to take a break here in a moment or two, and we'll pick that up. But do you see China being able to come out from underneath this population collapse? How is it going to do it? Here in the United States, we just open the borders and they mm-hmm. come flowing in. Nobody wants to flow into China like yeah. they do the United States.
Yeah. Hopefully they will be able to reverse it. But it's definitely some very troubling trends right now that we're getting. China is getting pretty close to the point of no return, if they haven't passed it already, for sure.
What does that mean, the point of no return?
Meaning that the past 2-3 generations that haven't been having children, as that generation grows up, there aren't anybody to replace them in the workforce. And so now we're having, China's having all of these issues of having to shut down schools completely because there's no kids to fill the schools. There's no preschools anymore because there's no children to put in these preschools. And let alone when those children grow up and grow out of these elementary ages, there's no one to replace in the workforce. And so when you're growing and getting older and then you go on Social Security and you retire and there's nobody to replace.
Nobody to pay your way.
Yeah, exactly.
And in a really weird sense, Paul Ehrlich was right for the wrong reason. And yeah. It gets right down to it. Well, ladies and gentlemen, you're tuned into the Food Chain Radio program. Michael Olson, your host for this hour. And today we have Samantha Lejeune, who's a researcher with the Population Research Institute. And we're going to be talking about food and population, and specifically infertility on the menu. Doesn't sound very promising, but we're going to tackle it anyway. So please do stay tuned. We will be right back after these messages.
now, back to What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, biologist Paul Ehrlich from Stanford said that it was all over for the population of the world because in the interim of in the 1970s, we were just going to run out of food. Well, we didn't run out of food because largely because we changed the way we were growing food. And we adopted this technologies of that Norman Borlaug put forth, the father of the Green Revolution, the Nobel Peace Prize winner for having saved 1 billion people from starvation. And we changed the way we did agriculture, and we produced a lot more of a few kinds of food. And so the world is not starving. There seems to be enough food to go around. Or am I mistaken, Samantha Lejeune? Is there enough food to go around now?
You're correct. There's more than enough food to go around. The issue lies in the distribution, the concentration of where that food goes to.
So does that mean like food deserts? Is that what you're talking about when you say distribution?
Yeah, I mean, there are still people who don't have access to food. It's not for America's lack of being able to produce food or the world's lack of having enough food that is growing. We do have enough food that we are producing as a world, but getting it to people that need the food is the issue.
Okay. Now, in my thinking about population issues, and specifically population declines, I always think of governments first as being the principal cause of population declines. I think specifically of a few instances, for example, Mao's Great Famine. It was Mao's policies that essentially eradicated the technologies the farmers of 40 centuries that had been feeding Chinese population for 40 centuries and collectivizing those farms and turning him into a collective instead of an entrepreneurial farmer. And as a consequence of that and other things, many tens of millions of people were starved to death. There was also Stalin's great Holodomor, in which he starved to death many millions of Ukrainian people. There's North Korea that always seems to be starving. So I look at governments as being one of the biggest causes of population crashes. Your thoughts?
I think when it comes to the issue of starvation, I think that is a really key player, is the government and the regulation of food and how it gets distributed, and then causing the starvation and the lack of food because of those regulations that the government has put in place. As far as population decline goes, there's quite a few key factors. One is societal, and that is with the introduction of the birth control pill. A lot of women have focused more on, you know, jobs and having a career that they were never able to do before. And now they can, quote unquote, take control of their fertility in a way. And that seems really appetizing. So when you focus on a career, especially in America, where we are so success and progress oriented, your career becomes your family, it becomes your child. And then when you get to a place in your career that you are happy with, you're probably 40 years old, and then you're ready to settle down, and you can't have a child. Because, you know, you've just been putting it off, saying that you're able to get pregnant when you're late 30s, early 40s, when you're comfortable in your career. And then it comes to this devastating, you know, you're not able to have children. Mm-hmm. So what we're seeing in this population decline trend is not so much a trend towards having smaller families, but it is an epidemic of childlessness. So women aren't having children, period, instead of having smaller families. And that's the issue we're really encountering, is infertility, first off. which I know we're going to go into later, but also this societal kind of mentality, especially in America, to prioritize other things. Right. And you're a woman is, you know, if she just wants to be a mother, it's looked down upon. It's looked as you're not unlocking your full potential. You're wasting, you know, your time or whatever. But I think that mentality societally, not to mention the economics, it's much more difficult to have a child now economically. But then also you have the biological factor too.
Well, before we go to the biological factor, I'd like to talk about urbanization. Mm-hmm. And because this is something that happened here in the United States in the past, maybe 50 years ago, we all moved into town. And once we moved into town, we discovered that the children that we had on the farm are no longer assets, cheap labor, but they're a liability. They cost a lot of money. Mm-hmm. You see that in China, too, where so many people moved off the farm or the countryside and into the city and into their 800 square feet apartments that there's really difficult to have children. As I was pondering this show this morning, I ran across an article at just from Consumer Affairs that laid on the table the cost of raising a child in California per year, $23,235 per year to raise a child, $2,700 to raise a dog. So that's significant for people. They have to come up with an extra $25,000, $24,000 per child to raise a child here in California. That's a lot of money. Mm-hmm. And so people don't have, like you said, that just surviving becomes a career, and surviving well and achieving a successful career really makes it hard to have a child. Now, I've come to see that as an employer, and it's always easier to hire those without children, because those without children don't have to go to soccer games or nurse sick children or do homework at night. And therefore, they're always much more available for the employer. And so how, you know, that's a significant hiring disincentive for mothers and fathers of children when it gets right down to it. You have to, it's almost like you have to sneak a child into this world.
Yeah, especially when we're in a society, like you were saying, that, you know, it is so much more appealing. And it's just, it's better business to hire somebody that doesn't have children. But that comes at a very high cost, that now people aren't having children. Exactly.
But it's not a cost we, the employers, have to pay at at this time. It's something we can put off until it's probably too late, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's right now, it's more of a theoretical threat that we're seeing. And I think that makes it very difficult for the average American to come to terms and realize what's happening, is that we're not seeing the effects of it right now.
In China, it's no longer a theoretical threat.
Exactly.
And everybody is scratching their head, trying to come to grips with how they're going to deal with this. It's actually an existential issue for the country.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's what we're trying to avoid, and put out this dire need and this dire call to action that we must do something now to reverse this steep and ever increasingly declining population trend. Just recently, the Congressional Budget Office said deaths are going to outpace births in about 8 years, which is 7 years sooner than they predicted last year. So this decline is continually becoming more rapid. And the closer we get to this population collapse, the more it's substantializing. But the more we're seeing that our predictions of this is something we'll deal with in two generations, this is something we'll deal with in 100 years, maybe 150 years, it's now. It is within our lifetime. It's within the decade.
Now or never.
Yeah, exactly.
For China, it's never.
Yeah, they've gotten to that point. And now they're trying to grasp at straws and do something to try to undo what had been done for centuries. Not centuries, but for decades. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
So, given all of that, we get to food. So already it's nearly an impossibility to have a child. You have to sneak them into the world. You have to sneak them into our society now. And it's becoming increasingly more difficult, as you write in Infertility on the Menu. It's becoming increasingly difficult for many young adults to have children. And we look for the reason why. And even for those of us, even those who want to have children, are having trouble conceiving and carrying to term and so on. So Infertility on the Menu seems to be that you're suggesting that food is a possible culprit here.
Yes, and that is what science is starting to really figure out, that yes, there are many other factors, but this large infertility crisis that we're meeting, it's starting to look like it's food. And the more that you look into it, the more that you read the studies and you look at these chemicals, these 100,000 approved chemicals and additives to put into our food, it's having an effect. This isn't just something that you consume and your body can deal with. Our body has evolved, but our body is very resilient. But it is also a fine-tuned machine that it can make out of what you give it. And so when we're giving it these plastics and these chemicals and these additives and these preservatives and phthalates, there's going to be consequences, and we're seeing those consequences largely and most concerningly in infertility.
Well, our bodies have evolved to cope with many different adversities, but that evolution takes time.
Yeah.
Many of these chemicals are in the past 50 years or so, which is nothing in evolutionary times.
Absolutely.
So these are essentially new threats for which our bodies have no knowledge of how to deal with.
Yeah.
I think the one I always point to first and foremost is glyphosate, mostly because we use more glyphosate, which is the weed killer Roundup. We use more glyphosate than anything because it kills weeds and we don't have to kill them ourselves. Great service to agriculture. But when it comes to those people who eat food, it's always a matter of what's in it for us other than food that has been drenched in herbicides.
Exactly. And, you know, you're suggested to wash it before eating. But, you know, when you think about it, how much is running kale under the sink going to get off those chemicals that have just been completely painted on? And then,
or infused systemically.
Exactly.
So it's they're drenched in herbicides and infused in pesticides. And so that's what we're eating. And those pesticides were designed with one purpose in mind: kill pests. Now, we're eating this stuff and wondering why we're not having babies.
Exactly. And so these pesticides are a huge huge component as to these chemicals that we're consuming. And there's typically some fruits that have fruits and vegetables that have more pesticides than others that you can like that you can look out for. But we're seeing that it's not only the pesticides, but these preservatives also. And even since 1991, the funeral directors and morticians are saying that bodies aren't decomposing like they used to because of all the preservatives that people
have. Oh my God, are you kidding me?
In their lifetime. Yes, it doesn't just preserve fruit and vegetables from decaying. It's preserving the human body from decaying, typically.
So it's like mummifying what's left of us then.
Yeah.
These preservatives that we're eating for food. It's almost incomprehensible. So it's not just preservatives, it's additives for colors for and so on. Let's talk about some of them. I guess we're just about ready to take a break. But when we come back, there are compounds like propylparaben, which is found in pastries and tortillas.
Yes.
And it has been found to have a direct impact on fertility. So, ladies and gentlemen, as you go for that bagel this morning, have a mind for what could possibly be in there, which is a termination of your future. Simple as that. This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson, your host for this hour. Today, we're honored to have Samantha with us from the Population Institute, Population Research Institute, Samantha Lejeune, and you. So do stay tuned. When we come back, we're going to look at the chemicals and figure out how to get out from underneath them and have a future.
You can earn a substantial income by farming for the city. All you need to do is take your crop to market and win the competition for the consumer dollars. There is a well-proven strategy for winning this competition. You will find it embedded in MetroFarm, the guide to growing in or near the city for the city.
Port Ideas, Greg Williams.
There's a tremendous amount of useful information in MetroFarm for farming in or near the city.
Acres USA's Charles Walters.
MetroFarm tells how to convert an opportunity into a real going concern. Every chapter is organized around the logic of practicality. For every problem needing a solution, MetroFarm offers a progression of steps arranged in sequence so the desired goal is achieved.
Before you plant your seeds, pick up a copy of the Ben Franklin Book of the Year award-winning MetroFarm. Then plant your seeds and win the dollars. MetroFarm.com. MetroFarm.com.
We're on the farm with Joel Salatin.
Would you like to buy homemade soup, backyard chicken, and the neighbor's artisanal lunch meat? The Farm to Consumer Legal Defense Fund protects your right to acquire the food of your choice from the source of your choice. I'm Joel Salatin from Polyface Farm, and I urge you to defend the right of neighbors to engage in direct food commerce. Join today at farmtoconsumer.org, the food of your choice from the source of your choice. That's farmtoconsumer.org, farmtoconsumer.org. Thank you.
When you buy local American-grown flowers, flowers will grow and flourish in America. Hello, I'm Deborah Prinzing, author of Slow Flowers for Certified American-Grown Flowers. When you buy local flowers, you're helping our country's family farms reduce the transportation footprint of flowers and enjoy fresher, longer-lasting bouquets. So please, next time you shop for flowers, think local. Think Certified American-Grown Flowers. Visit AmericanGrownFlowers.org to learn more.
History buffs, this tale from Michael Olson's Tales from a Tin Can took place aboard the USS Dale during the opening moments, 7 December 1941.
As we left our berth and got underway, the deck force was still engaged in getting ready for combat. Fuller had the job of clearing the deck of all the wooden objects that had collected in port, so Fuller was making his way aft, just tossing stuff like a madman, when he came to the ice cream freeze. Before he could toss it over the side, one of the guys said, "Hey, wait a minute!" In a matter of seconds, the lock was broken and the ice cream distributed among the crew. So, what you saw that morning was the USS Dale steaming hell-bent out to the channel while the guys back aft were standing by their guns, eating ice cream, and watching World War II break out all around.
Tales from a Tin Can contains 424 tales by 44 sailors aboard the USS Dale, from Pearl Harbor to Tokyo Bay. Order your Father's Day copy at talesfromatincan.com. That's talesfromatincan.com.
So much to say,
so little time to say it, on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, yes, ladies and gentlemen, we are eating a lot of things that is putting our future at risk. Things such as like glyphosate, weed killer, for example, a pesticide, an herbicide. But what about propylparaben, which is found in pastries and tortillas? What do they put that propylparaben in tortillas for?
It's known as a preservative. So it keeps these pastries and these tortillas very shelf stable. So you get the companies get more bang for their buck.
Okay, so reduces spoilage on the shelves, right?
It does.
Good. Phthalates.
Yes, those are some very dangerous chemicals that have been specifically shown to cause reproductive issues. And those are in not only our food, but a lot of our household supplies and products, our self-care products, lotion, a lot of fragrances have phthalates in them. And even we've seen phthalates in extreme amounts in Yoplait yogurt, Wendy's crispy chicken nuggets, and even some peaches from Del Monte. And so we're seeing these absurdly high amounts of phthalates in these normal products that, you know, you wouldn't think would have these preservatives or chemicals in them.
Is it a preservative?
Phthalates? Yes, I believe so, yeah.
So it does something for our industrial foods that preserves them or does something else. Forever chemicals.
Yeah, PFAS.
The PFAS.
Yes, those polyfluoroalkyl substances. They just stay in your body forever.
Now, what do they put in our food for?
They're not as predominantly in our food. They're mostly in our food packaging. And so that is, like BPA is a PFAS. And so we're starting to see a lot more of no BPA or it's BPA free, which is great, but there's many other different types. And so when you get like a soda cup that has that waxy coating on the inside to make it water resistant, those are PFAS. And so even when you get coffee in a hot to go cup, that heat and that boiling coffee is going to melt that plastic and it's going to seep into that drink. And then you're consuming these chemicals that have been shown to stay in your body forever. And especially with to-go food containers and, you know, all these different things of when you steam your vegetables, that plastic bag that you're steaming your vegetables in gets so hot that the plastic and those particles will move onto your food and then you consume them. And so we're seeing a lot more that these aren't just chemicals that stay in their place, essentially, especially when it comes to cooking and heating it up and putting in hot beverages and hot foods and putting in the microwave. Those chemicals are seeping into your food for you to consume.
Well, we hear that we bunch them all up together and put them in a class of things that we call endocrine disruptors.
Yes. So endocrine disruptors is kind of a classification of a poor effect that a chemical or additive can have. So these endocrine disruptors will enter the body and will either mimic a hormone and go onto the hormone receptor and trigger a hormone response that wasn't initially meant to be triggered, or it will block the hormone receptor so that the intended hormone won't be able to bind to the receptor and trigger the intended hormone response. So what we're seeing is that with these endocrine disruptors, hormones regulate almost every process of your body. So much of your body is run on a feedback loop of hormones. And so when this is getting messed with and distraught, we're seeing a lot of these ramifications, especially in metabolism. It's been shown that 93% of Americans now have metabolic dysfunction. And we think that it's because of these endocrine disruptors that these hormones aren't able to function properly. They aren't able to perform these processes that they have been made and designed to do. And so most concerningly, the hormone feedback loop that isn't functioning properly is the reproductive system. And so we're seeing a lot of these hormones that are being blocked. And so women aren't able to ovulate the way they should be. Sperm count is going down and sperm quality and motility is going down because these reproductive systems aren't functioning the way they should be because of these endocrine disruptors. And it's been proven that our sex hormones are largely regulated by our diet, especially ultra processed foods and sugars and starches really have a devastating effect. And we've seen massive shifts in our sex hormones with, you know, that diet.
You write in Infertility on the Menu, as the American diet, standard diet, has become increasingly synthetic, fertility in the United States has plummeted. One study found that men today have 60% less sperm than their grandfather's generation did. The results indicate that if this decline is not reversed, the sperm count in American men will fall to zero by 2025. That is zero as in no children. Gosh, you're sounding like Paul Ehrlich.
Yeah. It should, hopefully, just a quick correction, it should be 2045 that the sperm should be zero. So we've still got a little bit of time left to reverse.
We have what, 20 years?
Yeah, 20 years.
20 years of eating this food,
mm-hmm.
and we're zero. We go to zero.
Yeah.
And it's not just men that are having this problem. The female polycystic ovary syndrome and endometriosis are on the rise, as are the diagnosis of hormone imbalances, inflamed ovaries, and poor egg quality, all of which lead to higher miscarriage rates.
Yeah, and that's what's worse. That's what's being shown is that more and more, it's because of the food that we're eating, and we're seeing the quality of eggs is going down. Sperm motility and the concentration, like you were saying, is devastating. It's on a horrible downtrend that we need to actively reverse.
It seems as though the Green Revolution foods that Norman Borlaug made possible with his Green Revolution have been captured by industrial processes and turned into food that is not really food at all.
Yeah, it's become much more of a business. Food has become a lot less of a necessity to survive and more of a business and a business plan. And so you're looking to, you know, how long can this product last before it goes bad and we lose money on it? If we can put these chemicals in there to make it look more appetizing, taste sweeter, and stay on the shelf longer, then yeah, that's going to be a great business move. But at the detriment of our society and our population.
Which, as the business that's making the food, will not have to worry about because we have 20 more years before we get to zero, right? Goodness sakes. So, we need to make America healthy again. How are we going to do it?
Me too. And hopefully with RFK Jr., we will be able to. Having him be appointed the Secretary of the Department of Health and Human Services will hopefully make a big splash and promote a lot more regulations and a lot more rigorous testing for these chemicals that we put in our foods.
Also, I think holding up China's situation to the world might help people come to the realization that there, but for the grace of God, go we.
Yeah, exactly. And kind of like what we were talking about earlier, turning that theoretical threat into a real one that we have seen and that we can look to China as this example and this lesson to learn from, that we don't want to do that. We don't want to go down there. We're not going to continue down this path that we are on right now.
So it seems as though the recent administration saw the intent to make America great again. And even California governor has suggested that he's going to war against these chemicals in food. So maybe there is a change in how we're actually looking at our food. Maybe we're opening our eyes to that in our food, which we can't see, but we know is there. They're like little body invasion of the body snatchers, aren't they? They just there's nothing to stop them.
No.
Once we eat these foods, these chemicals ride right along with the food and enter our body and into our all of our body's metabolic processes, and wreak havoc.
There are a few things that we can do to try to reverse these trends and you know, undo what's been done through the food chemicals.
Yeah. Do you think we need to have a new green revolution?
I think we need to have a more precise green revolution, especially in getting back to a more natural food, into food that gives our body the nutrients that it needs and not the chemicals that we don't.
Mm-hmm. I often point to China. In the year 1900, China had 400 million people, and they were all fed by farmers with a half an acre of land. Now, most city people would not want to be a farmer, but there are a lot that would. And I think to actually grow the kind of food that you're talking about, we need farmers and not chemicals.
Yeah.
And chemicals were adopted to replace people on the land. And so I'm thinking we just might need a new green revolution and, like you said, a more precise one. But how do you fight big money? That is the money that's being made selling us these things are putting an end to us.
Yeah, and hopefully with this new appointment of RFK Jr., we'll be able to more effectively fight it, whether that is getting it into legislature and having more regulations and more reliability and safety within these mm-hmm. chemicals, and eliminating the chemicals in general that we haven't studied to the full extent. We haven't done these long-term studies on that are proving to be very dangerous.
Well, as we talk about making America great again, Pepsi Cola and Coca-Cola and Frito-Lay, and boy, the lobbyists are flying to Washington, D.C. with suitcases full of cash. Will we be able to resist that somehow?
I hope we will be able to. And I think each of us can do our part to try to stand up for, you know, getting a more natural and safe food.
Well, I'm for one, am certainly hopeful that that's the case. I guess if I have a jihad in life, it's that, is going back to real food grown by real farmers in real soil. And I think it's going to be a tough row to hoe. But I don't know if we have a choice. Do we?
I don't think that we do. At this rate that we're going, we have no other choice but to fight back and to change the way that we're eating and to change the American standard diet.
So as a population researcher, you point to us having 20 years before we hit zero sperm.
That's for the sperm count. As far as general population, we're going to need to reverse those trends a little bit more quickly in the next like 15 years.
So there is no time to waste.
No. And there are some small things that we can be doing now that isn't just waiting for laws to be put into place or for the FDA to be, you know, revised. You and anybody can make these small changes at home, whether that be not using plastic, you know, kitchenware, no plastic spatulas, changing your Teflon pans and your nonstick pans to stainless steel, you know, maybe not using a coffee to go cup that you're given at, you know, the coffee shop, bringing your own mug, bringing your own metal water bottle. And, you know, if you want to steam vegetables in the bag, take it out. You have your own metal water bottle. But if you want to, you know, steam vegetables, take it out of the bag and then microwave it that way. So there are some small steps that we can make, that we can change within our own lives to seek more fertility in a more healthy body that isn't filled with these endocrine disruptors.
Okay, Samantha Lejeune, one quick last question. Are you sure that you and Stephen Mosher are not being another Paul Ehrlich and warning of this population collapse? Are you sure that you're on the right track here?
We definitely are. We are warning the opposite of what he is saying, is that we're at, you know, overpopulated, and we're coming the opposite way of people that are the world's most valuable resource. And we need to foster that, and we need to create better and stronger and bigger families.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Michael.
Samantha Lejeune, researcher at Population Research Institute, member, ladies and gentlemen, Michael Olson, third law of the food chain, cheap food isn't. Thank you so much, Samantha.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.